It's the Friday News Roundup on 1A. I'm Jen White. For the next hour, we'll catch up on some of the biggest stories overseas. There's more off-court drama down under and an ongoing standoff between the U.S. and Russia. Also, North Korea's leader is back with some new rockets. We'll hear what's different and alarming about his latest ballistic barrage. Joining us this week, Vivian Salama, national security reporter for the Wall Street Journal and former Baghdad bureau chief for the Associated Press. Vivian, it's great to have you back.
Hi, Jen.
Also with us is David Rennie. He's the Beijing bureau chief for The Economist. David, welcome.
Hello.
And Nancy Youssef, a national security correspondent for the Wall Street Journal. Nancy, Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you.
So we start in Melbourne, Australia, with an ongoing COVID-related saga that involves the world's number one men's tennis player. Novak Djokovic's visa has been revoked again. He's in the country for the Australian Open, which starts Monday. Now, he and his team admit they broke the country's strict vaccination rules, and the fresh uncertainty over whether he'll be allowed to play has many asking why he hasn't been put on the next plane home, and one of them is tennis star Martina Navratilova.
The best thing for Novak to do, I think, would be to just say, you know what, there were too many mistakes. This is not okay. I would be the only unvaccinated player, as I understand it, to play in the Australian Open. I think everybody that has not been vaccinated has been sent back. And the right thing to do is just to go home. It's just the right thing to do, but I don't think he will do that because he wants that 21st title.
Vivian, what's the latest and how much trouble is he in?
So Djokovic has had his visa canceled for the second time on Friday in just 3 days. And that's just before he was set to play in the 2022 Australian Open. The decision was handed down on Friday by the immigration minister, Alex Hawke, who essentially said it was in the public interest to do so. And this has been sort of the latest chapter in a week-long saga. Since Djokovic arrived in Australia, his COVID status, his vaccination status, completely uncertain, and he's sort of been a bit of a rebel when it comes to some of these protocols. And Australia, being one of the strictest when it comes to lockdowns and COVID protocols, took no chances. Even though he was allowed to arrive in the country, he's been essentially in limbo, in immigration detention, waiting to hear his fate. And he is signed up to play officially in the Open, which begins on Monday. But whether or not he will actually be allowed to or deported, that's the big question at this stage.
Well, Nancy, there are legal arguments being played out, but how much is the story complicated by how Djokovic is viewed in the tennis world?
Well, I think that is a factor because the reality is, at the risk of offending tennis fans, I think he's seen as petulant. I think the most sort of notable example that might come to mind is during the 2020 U.S. Open when he swung his racket and with his tennis ball, appeared to have said he accidentally hit a line judge. But there have also been other instances where he has, frankly, thrown a bit of sorts. Here during the Australian Open last year, he asked had a laundry list of requests, including a private room and courts for players. And so I think that feeling that he has asked for rules to not be applied to him or exceptions to be made for him in the face of his contemporaries, Nadal and Federer, who are seen as gentlemanly and are so beloved. All three of them have 20 Grand Slams under their belts. And I think his reputation contrasted to that of other tennis players in his league, I think, has been a contributing factor to the tension around this latest controversy.
David, what good options are there for the government here? Now, they can kick him out and risk the blowback from fans who want to see him defend his title. But if a new appeal lets him stay, they can expect huge pushback over double standards.
They can. And I think what's really interesting is that if this had happened a year ago, it would have been a public health question. We'd have been arguing about whether he was going to spread COVID. Remember, Australia, taking advantage of being a giant island, had completely closed its borders, not just to foreigners, but to Australians at some points last year. But since then, Australia is one of the countries that's decided it just cannot keep up a policy of completely zero COVID, particularly with this very transmissible new Omicron variant. And so they're now trying to transition to living with COVID. And so now, actually, it's really striking that when you listen to things like the comments from the Australian Prime Minister justifying this latest kind of withdrawal of the visa, he's making really a political argument about what public opinion will wear. And so Scott Morrison, the Prime Minister, said that Australians made many sacrifices during this pandemic. And they rightly expect the result of those sacrifices to be protected. And it's really interesting that in the court hearings going on kind of right now, Djokovic's lawyers are saying, well, hang on, this is getting very political. The immigration minister is presenting this as a case of, if he's allowed to say, it will excite anti-vaccine sentiments. And so you see how this is no longer a public health question. It's a giant political argument. And there, I guess, the government is looking to their own domestic public opinion and trying to work out where to stand on that.
Well, and we mentioned that the tournament is Monday. Is there any likelihood this question won't be answered before then?
So Djokovic's lawyers appeared in court today, Friday, and they said that they would like to have a hearing on Sunday, which is unusual but could happen. And their argument being that they need the case to be decided on Sunday in a federal court so that he can play on Monday if needs be. But you've seen other tennis stars sort of asking, is he getting to practice? Isn't he going back into detention on Saturday morning? And so the whole thing really is turning into a bit of a circus. And it looks as though both sides are dug in on a kind of point of ideological principle, really, about how to handle COVID and vaccination.
We're talking to David Rennie, Beijing Bureau Chief for The Economist, Nancy Youssef, National Security Correspondent for The Wall Street Journal, and Vivian Salama, National Security Reporter for The Wall Street Journal and former Baghdad Bureau Chief for The Associated Press. We're also hearing from you. Kokomo Kid tweets, Djokovic should be treated the same as any other anti-vaxxer trying to enter Australia. He should not get special favors because he is rich and famous. Well, moving to another part of the world, is the party over for the British Prime Minister, Boris Johnson?
Mr. Speaker, I want to apologise.
He was hosting boozy parties in Downing Street.
I regret very much.
The only question is, will the British public kick him out? Will his party kick him out? Or will he do the decent thing and resign? Yeah.
Johnson apologized in the House of Commons on Wednesday and to the Queen Friday for attending a bring-your-own-booze party in the garden of the Prime Minister's Downing Street office. Now, this goes back to May of 2020. That's when his staff were invited to what was billed as a socially distanced drinks event. At the time, Brits were banned by law from meeting more than one person outside their households as part of measures to curb the spread of coronavirus. David, The Economist wrote this week, quote, Britain chose a party animal for its leader. Now comes the hangover. What changed this week?
I think what changed was we had a leak of an email from one of the most senior officials in Downing Street, basically a smoking gun, proving that the very top of Downing Street knew that there was a party taking place. It took place, as you say, at a time when in May 2020, Britain was extremely strictly locked down. It took place about an hour and a half, 2 hours after a cabinet minister had been on television sternly instructing the British public that they couldn't meet more than one other person in an outdoor park because it would be too dangerous. And then you have this sort of cheerful email from the principal private secretary of the Prime Minister saying, you know, it's a lovely day. We've all been working very hard. Why don't we have a bring your own party? And just in case you think his week couldn't get worse, you mentioned just now that he had to apologise to the Queen. So number 10 has apologised to the Queen because it now turns out that in 2021, so last year, the night before the funeral of Prince Philip, and everyone remembers those incredibly sad photographs of the Queen on her own in the pews in Windsor in the chapel, the night before there were two staff parties in number 10, which went on into the small hours at a time when everyone else in Britain was banned. And the point about him being a party animal is that the British public knew that he was a rackety figure who tells lies, who's flamboyant, who doesn't believe in rules. And that was all kind of appealing when he was elected and chosen as leader. But now it's about everyone else having to obey the rules, people missing funerals of their own grandparents because they were banned from attending a large event, people dying alone in hospitals because their families weren't allowed to meet them. And at exactly the same time, this flamboyant libertarian, I don't care about rules guy was sort of palling it up in the garden of number 10. And that has really changed the atmosphere.
Well, another difference this time around is that those calling for his resignation include some in Johnson's own Conservative Party. And this is one of them, Member of Parliament Caroline Noakes.
He looks like a liability. And I think he either goes now or he goes in 3 years' time at a general election. And it's up to the party to decide which way round that's going to be. He's damaging us now. He's damaging the entire Conservative brand with an unwillingness to accept the strictures that other people have lived by.
Well, and Nancy, given the sacrifices so many have made over the past 2 years, David laid them out beautifully for us. Why would any lawmaker think they could get away with such blatant rule breaking?
Because the rules haven't applied to Boris Johnson throughout his tenure. We talked about this being Partygate, but it's actually party gates, and that they keep happening, these controversies. And this isn't even the first time he's faced the accusation of parties around his staff during COVID last year. At the end of last year, there was talk about a Christmas party in which, and how staffers were sort of mocking how they would answer questions about the party. He's had controversies around whether he had fundraisers to refurbish his apartment. And everyone assumed that this was a political figure with many lives. And so here we are. He's facing another controversy. And this time, I think the party is saying, is he becoming such that now it's affecting our ability to hold on to power?
Our guests on the roundup this week are Nancy Youssef. She's a national security correspondent for The Wall Street Journal. Also with us, David Rennie, Beijing bureau chief for The Economist, and Vivian Salama from The Wall Street Journal. She covers national security and has reported from more than 75 countries. If you have questions about this week's global news, you can send us a tweet at 1A, email us at 1A@WAMU.org, or leave a message on our Facebook page. I'm Jen White. You're listening to 1A. I'm Jen White. It's the Friday News Roundup on 1A. We're wrapping up the biggest stories from overseas with Nancy Youssef, a national security correspondent for The Wall Street Journal, David Rennie, Beijing bureau chief for The Economist, and Vivian Salama, national security reporter for The Wall Street Journal and former Baghdad bureau chief for The Associated Press. One more bit of COVID-related news. Vivian, Quebec's political leaders promised to introduce a tax on unvaccinated Canadians. What impact has that had?
That's right, Jen. We don't actually know what the fine is going to be, so knowing what the impact is going to be as far as people's pockets remains to be seen. They haven't offered any specifics. But what they did say is that immediately after this announcement was made, in an effort, of course, to get people vaccinated, they saw that nearly 90% of eligible Quebecois received at least, who had received at least one dose, went back to sign up for more vaccines. And so they said that it's been clear that this could potentially work to improve the public health situation. Obviously, a number of people expressing anger at the move, because they said that, you know, it basically discriminates against people's choice. But what the government has said is that this is something that they believe is very important. They did say that they would offer medical exemptions for folks who don't want to take the vaccine for medically approved reasons. But for the most part, they are trying to get people back in the workplaces, and to do so, they feel that imposing these strict vaccine mandates, including a potential penalty against those who are not vaccinated, is very important to achieving that. And so we will see in the coming days and weeks how it kind of unfolds. But for now, they say they have seen an uptick, which was really what they were looking for.
Well, let's move on to Russia, where talks to resolve differences with Ukraine have stalled. A top Russian official has said that there are, quote, no grounds to continue attempts to diffuse tension over Ukraine's aim to join NATO. That's the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. Now, David, Putin does not want Ukraine to join NATO, even though no one expects that to happen anytime soon. What does Russia want?
Well, what Russia is asking for is an extraordinary list, which would basically reverse some of the really kind of big shifts of large parts of Eastern Europe towards the Western world and NATO that happened after the fall of the Berlin Wall. So he's not just saying this promise that was extracted in the last days of the George W. Bush era that Ukraine would have a path to joining NATO must be revoked and cancelled. He's also saying that he wants NATO to stop having military infrastructure in former bits of the Soviet bloc. So that's countries that are now members of NATO, members of the European Union, like the Baltic Republics. He's also saying he wants a kind of a massive changes to things like exercises, missile deployments. So he's basically trying to rewrite the security architecture of a huge sphere of influence beyond Russia's borders, deep into NATO and the European Union. So that's not realistic. And so this brinksmanship, it's very unclear what he does want. I thought it was fascinating that Wendy Sherman, the US Deputy Secretary, literally said that we don't know what the Russians really want. She said in their talks in Brussels, there were three sets of talks this week, and the middle one was with NATO in Brussels. And Wendy Sherman, the Deputy Secretary, said, Russia needs to decide whether they're really about security, in which case they need to engage with us, or whether this is just a pretext, and perhaps Russia itself doesn't even know yet. And I think that sort of speaks to the real sense of unease on the Western side, on the American and NATO side, that Russia is playing these very dramatic games with these 100,000 at least troops on the border of Ukraine. And then we've seen US intelligence, no doubt you'll ask about this, someone else, US intelligence leaking today what they think is potentially a false flag operation, which will give them a pretext to invade. But because the Russian demands are so completely unrealistic, it's very unclear what Putin's end game is other than sort of destabilizing and sowing chaos.
Well, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken talked to NPR's Mary Louise Kelly about the role of the U.S. in the Russia-Ukraine conflict.
If they choose confrontation, if they choose aggression, we're fully prepared for it. We have spent weeks, months now, working in very close coordination with allies and partners at the G7, the EU, NATO, to prepare for Russian aggression to make very clear that there'll be massive consequences if that's the path they pursue.
So, Nancy, right now Russian troops have gathered on the Ukrainian border, and we've heard right there that should they invade, there will be consequences. What does that mean? What would those consequences look like?
Well, there are primarily economic consequences, sanctions. The U.S. has said explicitly that military options, that is, U.S. military intervention, is not on the table. I think that the thing that's worth dissecting is that when the secretary says there are massive consequences, those consequences aren't just for Russia. They would have effects on the very allied nations who would be imposing them. If, for example, there's an elimination of SWIFT or other economic tools, that affects the region. If the Nord Stream pipeline is cut off, that affects oil distribution through the region. And so I think that's one of the challenges in terms of how the West responds to Russian action. And the other thing I would point out is those consequences happen after a military aggression by Russia. And I think it also speaks to the limitations and what the U.S. and its allies have been able to do to bring down the temperature vis-a-vis Russia and Ukraine.
Well, and David, how complicated is bringing down that temperature when, as you said, it's not clear what Russia really wants?
No, and it's very interesting that you saw Jake Sullivan, the National Security Advisor, when he was talking to reporters on Thursday, he said, we have intelligence that we're getting ready to kind of declassify, to release a bit. But what they're talking about is when they're talking about that they worry that Russia is trying to create an excuse to go into Ukraine. And on Friday, we saw today U.S. officials starting to talk to U.S. media about what they see. They say that there are Russian special services who will be potentially using sort of explosives against separatists armed and supported by the Russians in this region of eastern Ukraine that since 2014 has been held by pro-Russian separatists, basically supplied and armed as a kind of breakaway bit of Ukraine. If the Russian special forces attack Russia's own allies in that place, the fear is that that gives Putin an excuse to launch a full-on invasion. And the date, the timeline that these officials are briefing is sometime between mid-January and mid-February. So it'd be a kind of repeat of the playbook that Russia used when it invaded Crimea in the south of Ukraine in 2014. And that would be extraordinarily destabilizing once again.
Vivian, what's your sense of the urgency around resolving this issue or coming to some place that isn't this stalemate the West is in with Russia and Ukraine is in with Russia right now?
It is very urgent. Obviously, the U.S. and its allies across Europe are very nervous as Russia masses these troops near the border of Ukraine that it will try to invade once again, as it did in 2014. And any breach of sovereignty of a European nation is obviously a huge concern, you know, especially in 2022, where the West tends to emphasize that they have moved kind of past those kind of tactics in the world, sort of in the post-Cold War era especially, and that they want to find a diplomatic solution. But any effort to de-escalate these tensions thus far have really flailed, and the administration is growing increasingly worried about that. And it grows, it is much more of an issue not only of the potential dangers that are involved in an invasion of eastern Ukraine, but also just sort of this playbook that this administration has seen before and trying to kind of reassert the lessons that they have learned from the 2014 experience. Remember, Joe Biden was vice president in 2014, and a number of his advisors right now were around him in dealing with the crisis in 2014. And so they are trying now to kind of rewrite how it was handled in 2014 to say, okay, we are going to find a way to solve this before an invasion. We're going to try to find a way to de-escalate this. But that so far has not taken. And a lot of pressure now from Congress to do more, to act more swiftly in advance of an invasion, not only because obviously you don't want the sovereignty of Ukraine to be breached, but also it then sends a message to other countries, including China with regard to its own aggression toward Taiwan and other countries that might think, if Russia can get away with this, we can too. And so it really sets a precedent moving forward for how this administration will confront this kind of aggression.
Well, the panel spent a good chunk of time last week talking about the unrest in Kazakhstan. This week, Russian troops started to withdraw from the country. Nancy, just give us a quick update on what's happening there.
Sure. So after the protests and other violence erupted in Kazakhstan, the president there asked for help from Russia, and Russia sent in about 2,000 troops. And what was interesting is that we saw a reduction of violence, but also real questions about how the government there did it. There was internet was cut off, people were arrested, at least 10,000 were. There was a really violent confrontations between protesters and security forces. And the feeling now is that the situation is stabilized enough such that those forces can leave by January 19th. But we still don't have a clear sense of how that violence came down, whether the long-stemming issues that sort of spurred these protests will be addressed, and if so, and how. And we've seen now from the government describing the protesters as terrorists. We've seen the protesters saying that there were foreign actors came in that made, that brought violence into what they had as a protest designed to raise legitimate concerns. And so we're starting to see things on the face of it calm down, but real uncertainty about where Kazakhstan goes from here.
Vivian, what were your main takeaways from both those who protested and how the country responded to the protests?
Jen, it's really an interesting trend that we see in the post-Soviet world, where a lot of these issues, which are rooted in very straightforward domestic issues, like what we saw in Kazakhstan with the rollback of subsidies on liquefied petroleum gas.
Okay, I think we lost Vivian's line there. We'll work to get her back. David, what about for you? What did you take away from what it played out in Kazakhstan?
There's a couple of things. There's a domestic thing, which is it's an incredibly murky story. So my colleagues from The Economist in Kazakhstan have this extraordinary detail about how, as you say, some of those protests turned incredibly violent. And some of the protesters there said, hang on, the people who came and started being extremely violent, who started raiding state arsenals and taking guns out, seizing the airport, they were not our people. They were not political protesters who we'd expected to sort of stand in a public square and sing songs about more democracy. These look like mafia thugs taking an airport in a very strategic way. And there is a lot of rumors among diplomats and politicians in Kazakhstan that this was basically a failed coup attempt, and that perhaps the former dictator, Nursultan Nazarbayev, who's now in his 80s, but his family remains extremely powerful, they decided that they would take out the current president, who was basically put in place by the previous dictator, and that they hijacked these public protests and turned them into something else. Why should people sitting in America care about something so far away? I think because, like our previous story about Ukraine, this is about the health of the West versus a kind of autocratic Russia-China axis. China, here where I am in Beijing, waited all week saying that this was a color revolution being funded by the Americans, by the CIA, that this was terrorism. Because this is what the Russians and the Chinese want. It's a world where they get to crack down as hard as they like on these things they call terrorism, because they think the West is in disarray and disunity. And that's the test for the Biden administration, is the West actually still capable of responding to these kinds of challenges from the autocratic side of the world?
It's the Friday News Roundup. We're here with David Rennie, the Beijing bureau chief for The Economist. He joins us from the Chinese capital. Nancy Youssef, a national security correspondent for The Wall Street Journal, and Vivian Salama, national security reporter for The Wall Street Journal and former Baghdad bureau chief for the Associated Press. Let's talk about another nation the U.S. has an icy relationship with, North Korea. According to state-run media, the country conducted a hypersonic missile test earlier this week. And earlier today, North Korea reportedly launched another two ballistic missiles into the Sea of Japan. The country released a picture of leader Kim Jong-un observing the test. David, what makes this test of a hypersonic weapon so consequential?
So if you want to get nerdy, the fact that it's hypersonic on its own, which just means it flies several times the speed of sound, isn't actually that frightening. All kinds of ballistic missiles are hypersonic. What was very alarming about a couple of the North Korean tests was that they were saying that the warhead at the end of the top of the missile was capable of doing hypersonic maneuvering. Basically, what that means is that the Chinese have these things, the Americans are trying to develop, the North Koreans say. So in order to evade the missile defenses of the other side, you have a warhead that once it's released at sort of 5 or 10 times the speed of sound, can steer, can move, can make it move on a curve, can evade defenses or fly in very low. And the North Koreans claim that they pulled this off. Now, the missile tests that they've done so far, which they claimed steered around and were maneuverable, which would be a big dramatic increase in their capabilities, these are short-range, medium-range missiles that could not hit the United States. So for the moment, it's not an immediate threat. But you did see the Biden administration clearly alarmed by this capability in a country like North Korea. So immediately going back to the sanctions table, both domestically, the U.S. Treasury and State Department putting sanctions on some North Korean officials and some Russians, but then going to the UN and saying this is against UN Security Council resolutions going back years that North Korea has no right to develop these technologies. The problem there, though, is that Russia and China on the UN Security Council, particularly China, where there was a moment a few years ago where they were willing to sign up to sanctions because they were also alarmed by North Korea's bad behavior. Now China thinks this is all about America being to blame, that it's America's problem China is not going to play, and has been criticizing these sanctions and saying that it's America's fault for destabilizing the situation. So we're in a real mess where international unity in terms of confronting North Korea is in terrible shape.
Well, Nancy, why is North Korea doing this now? We've been seeing these missile tests for some time, but is there a ramping up of these tests? Is something changed?
Well, I think one indication of the ramp up is they did two what they claimed were hypersonic missile tests in the span of a week. And at that second one, Kim Jong-un was there, which I think signals that their belief that they're advancing their capabilities. It's the number of tests they're doing. It's the types of tests that they're doing. It's that these tests are coming at the expense of the well-being of the North Korean people. It's a Kim Jong-un who is rejecting the idea that was sort of put forth by the Trump administration that there could be some level of engagement, and is saying that essentially North Korea will be treated as a military threat to the international community, that it is to be dealt with in that manner, and that it's investing so much of its time and resources into getting that message across, and not and a real wholesale rejection, I think, of what was put forth under previous administrations, that there was some ability of dialogue at settling some of the tensions between the West and North Korea.
We'll have more from Vivian, Nancy, and David in a moment. News this week from the British singer Elvis Costello, who has told reporters that he'll no longer perform his biggest hit, Oliver's Army. He's also asked radio stations to stop playing the song. Released in 1979, the lyrics contain a racial slur used to describe Irish Catholics. Costello says, "That's what my grandfather was called in the British Army. It's a fact, but people hear that word and accuse me of something that I didn't intend." Well, that still leaves music we can play from Elvis Costello, who now lives in New York City. I'm Jen White, back with more in a moment. This is 1A. Now let's get back to the roundup. A reminder, we're with David Rennie from The Economist. He joins us from Beijing. Also, Nancy Youssef and Vivian Salama. They both cover national security and foreign policy for The Wall Street Journal. Before we move on, we got this tweet from David who says, "My Russian college professor said in 1990 that the Russians don't negotiate like we do. There is no meat in the middle. They start so far to one side and never let up, hoping to end up at 75-95% of what they want. It's a disconcerting strategy." And I'd love to hear your thoughts about what David says there. Nancy, I'll come to you first.
Well, I think David has an interesting point, and based on events we saw this week, it certainly has panned out that way. There were three attempts at negotiations, and what was interesting to me is that after the U.S. and NATO and Western allies came out of each of those briefings, they were almost disheartened at the inability to make progress. It's extraordinary to some degree that Wendy Sherman emerged out of nearly 8 hours of talks with the Russians and said, "We don't know what they want." And the list of demands that they're making, I think, as David so eloquently spelled out, is so beyond what the U.S. is willing to even consider discussing. There is no scenario where the U.S. would say, "We agree to never let Ukraine in." And so I think he raises an interesting point. The challenge is, to what end, if Russia enters Ukraine, is it doing so? What is the end state it hopes to achieve? And what does that sort of portend then in terms of how they proceed? Could we see a Russia that, for example, goes in a little bit into Ukraine, pauses, assesses the situation, does a little bit of what the listener spelled out, and that we, instead of thinking about this as an incursion that lasts for weeks or months, but really is instead the start of a weeks or months long process of Russia trying to maneuver its position vis-a-vis Ukraine?
Well, Mark tweets, "Putin's end game is to take over Ukraine. Am I the only one seeing this coming?" David, your thoughts?
Well, it's a big old country, and although there are clearly Russian nationalists that think of Ukraine as not even a real country at all, but basically part of a kind of new Russian hinterland, occupying a country full of Ukrainians who really would not enjoy being occupied by the Russians would be a big problem. You'd have a lot of insurgency, you could have a lot of unrest, you'd have to spend a tremendous amount of money that the Russians don't have occupying it. And one of the things we've seen about Putin is that he doesn't need to occupy places and run up his flag on a flagpole in the capital city. His favored MO is to have kind of deniability, to have troops without badges on, to have kind of allies and sort of nods and winks and destabilizing countries, to have these grumbling conflicts that cause misery and death for people on the ground, but rumble on for years without ever being resolved. Even his threats at the moment towards Ukraine are intensely ambiguous. He talks about, "We will be forced to take military technical measures." He doesn't even want to kind of be as open as saying we might invade, because the whole idea is, although they use kind of legal meetings and diplomats and, you know, ambassadors and people with kind of beautiful, shiny English, the truth is that what they're really doing is expressing a worldview where Russia deeply resents the idea that after the fall of the Cold War, after the fall of the Berlin Wall, that Russia was kind of bullied and pushed into a corner by an arrogant West. And it just wants to reset that balance in a kind of very visceral way, even if they play a lot of games to get there.
Vivian, anything to add?
Well, I mean, just to echo what both of them said, Putin believes that this is essential for his legacy. To have Ukraine as part of Russia's orbit is something that is so essential to him and something that he has talked about over and over again. I mean, I used to write during the Trump days that when Vladimir Putin met with Donald Trump, he used to lecture him for 20, 30 minutes sometimes about the links of between Ukraine and Russia dating back to like 1100 AD. And this is something that he thinks about and talks about constantly behind closed doors. And so this is something that regardless of what happens in the coming days and weeks and the efforts by the Biden administration, it's not going to go away. And I think the administration realizes that, you talk to officials now and they'll tell you it's not a question of if, but when Putin tries to make a move for eastern Ukraine again. And so we remain to see the escalations in the last couple of days and the faltering of the talks, very worrisome to a lot of people in the U.S. administration. So we'll see how it plays out.
Well, the opening ceremony of the Beijing Winter Olympic Games is only 3 weeks away, but Omicron is spreading in China. As of this week, at least three cities in China are under lockdown after COVID cases surfaced. 20 million Chinese citizens are now confined to their homes or others' homes. One woman on social media went viral this week. She chronicled being stuck at a blind date's house for days after his city went into swift lockdown. David, most of the lockdown stories in China are not so lighthearted. What's happening on the ground in these places?
Basically, China is the last big country that is committed to trying to have as close to zero COVID as possible. And I know many listeners will just say, well, they're lying. They are not telling the truth. Well, they're not even saying how many cases of Omicron they have. But it's not that they're not hiding whole cities that we don't know about, because their whole strategy is based on locking down, as you say, city after city. You know, as we sit here, I'm sitting here in Beijing on Friday. You know, the city nearest to me, Tianjin, has cases of Omicron. Shanghai, the giant business city, now has cases of COVID. Zhuhai down by Hong Kong. You know, it is spreading because Omicron is unbelievably contagious. But they are not about to change this policy of trying to lock down and isolate their way out of this. They've cancelled 74 flights so far this year, international flights. It's impossible to get a flight from America to China for the next 2 weeks, basically. Here in Beijing, we've been told don't leave Beijing. If you leave Beijing and you end up anywhere in China that has a single case anywhere near you, you will not be allowed to return. You know, my kids' school in Beijing has said everyone is banned from leaving Beijing for the next several weeks, or the kids can't go to school. It's unbelievably strict. They are not going to give in. And the Olympics, as you say, begins in 3 weeks. Something like 30,000 foreigners are going to arrive. They're going to try and keep them in a closed bubble of quarantine, but some of them are going to have Omicron because there is a lot of Omicron out there, and this is going to be a gigantic test. But for the moment, they seem to have no desire whatsoever to live with COVID as you were doing in the States.
Is it even clear how well China's strategy for containing COVID is working?
Look, most places don't have a lot of COVID, and you can tell that because they show the places that do. Do we believe the absolute numbers? So today, the latest number is there are 143 cases of COVID in China. Now, new cases, sorry, in one day. I mean, there are American shopping malls with 143 cases, you know, individual malls, right? So that's an extraordinary thing in a country with a fifth of the world's population, 1.4 billion people. The real problem is that they have not got good vaccines. They have refused for political reasons. They've refused to have Pfizer and Moderna and the other foreign vaccines. In fact, their propaganda machine continues to suggest that the foreign vaccines aren't even safe. The Chinese vaccines, which I stuck in my arm because I have no choice, they don't actually protect against Omicron at all, as far as we can tell. They don't have antivirals. Their hospital system is very weak. So they don't actually have a lot of options. But this country has been locked down pretty much completely for 2 years. And I don't think it's going to unlock this year. And I speak as someone who hasn't left China for 2 years. I haven't seen many of my family for 2 years. Mm-hmm. And it's not going to change for another year, I think.
Well, Nancy, what conversations are happening about COVID in China and abroad as the Olympic Games approach?
Well, I think the biggest one is, can the Olympics go safely forward? When you have, as David mentioned, 30,000 athletes coming in at any time, when you're dealing with a variant that's this contagious, when you're dealing with all the challenges, the logistical challenges under the best of circumstances that come with hosting the Olympics. We saw this in Japan and their efforts to host the Olympics that in the COVID period, we've seen an Olympics that's really been marred by questions around the coronavirus, that it hasn't been a games that have been centered around the athletes, but really about health issues. And so I think as we head into Olympic season, which is starting upon us very soon, I think we're once again headed to a time when we won't be talking just about the games, but whether it's responsible to even hold them.
Well, even with much of the Chinese public unable to leave their homes, the country welcomed some visitors this week. They were all top-level officials from the Gulf, including the foreign ministers of Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, Oman, and Bahrain. David, these visits indicate China's growing interest in the Middle East. What draw is there for Chinese leaders?
So the simple answer is things like oil. So China imports 70% of its crude oil, and China uses a lot of oil. And this Gulf Cooperation Council, which also has another couple of members, Qatar and the UAE, between them, they control almost half of the world's crude oil reserves. So that's reason one why they are there. China also is very keen to have Arab countries talking about how they support China's so-called anti-terrorism policies in Xinjiang, which have led to up to a million Muslims in Xinjiang being put into re-education camps over the last few years. Many Arab countries are willing to praise those policies and say they're fine by them. But if you really want to understand China's ambitions, don't just look at the Gulf Arab countries that had foreign ministers in China this week. Iran, sworn enemy of the Gulf Arab countries, their foreign minister was also here today. The Turkish foreign minister was here on Wednesday. So China is really betting that countries that hate each other have so much of a financial interest and an economic interest in dealing with China that China can be friends with all of them. China's even, you know, on reasonable terms with Israel, because China is all about business. China is all about China's interests. And their bet is that they can therefore avoid the quagmire of the Middle East that countries which actually believe in stuff like the United States fall into, where the US has to choose sides. China's like, no, we don't choose sides. We just buy stuff and sell stuff. And so we can deal with all of you at the same time.
Well, Vivian, how closely is the US watching these overtures?
They're watching it very closely. And one of the big consequences of the U.S. Trying to downgrade its presence in the Middle East is that other countries step in. And so this has been something that a number of officials have talked about for ages, is the warning that a decreased U.S. presence in the region could create a vacuum and allow Russia and China to step in and cement relationships with these governments, who on the one hand have a lot of money and are able to sort of have a transactional relationships with these countries, buying weapons and doing other kind of projects together, other kind of infrastructure, whatever. But on the other hand, also are not going to lecture each other about human rights abuses, genocide in China, or whatever the issue may be. They kind of leave each other to their own vices, and they don't see these lectures, as they call them, from the U.S. about these issues. And so sort of a match made in heaven for a lot of them, for the Gulf and China in particular, but also something that the U.S. watches very closely in the hope that they don't kind of lose that those ties with the countries, and that they can remain a dominant presence in the region as well.
Well, let's get to this tweet from Nathan, who says China has not been on lockdown for nearly 2 years. It has travel restrictions and has quarantined cities when there is a COVID surge. But the vast majority of China is open and functioning more so than many Western nations. David, you're in Beijing. What do you make of that tweet?
So that's true domestically. But my point was that China's external borders have been effectively locked since about late March 2020. And so that's why it's you can come in and out if you do 3 weeks quarantine. But the country has basically shut itself off to a remarkable extent. You know, the vast majority of international flights cancelled. It's extremely difficult to get in and out. The number of foreigners here is very, very small. That's what I mean by locked down.
We're talking to David Rennie from The Economist. He joins us from Beijing. Also, Nancy Youssef and Vivian Salama. They both cover national security and foreign policy for The Wall Street Journal. Let's end on the never-ending saga that surrounds the British royal family. On Thursday, the Queen stripped her second son, Prince Andrew, of his official royal duties. He now has no military or royal titles. It follows the fact that Prince Andrew now faces a civil case in a U.S. court over claims he sexually assaulted a 17-year-old, a charge the prince has considered consistently denied. Now, Nancy, this is related to his previous ties to both Jeffrey Epstein and Ghislaine Maxwell. What changed this week?
A couple things. A woman at the time, her name was Virginia Roberts, says that Prince Andrew sexually assaulted her while he was an associate of Jeffrey Epstein's, and she's gone forward with a lawsuit. And the prince had basically argued on sort of technical grounds that the lawsuit shouldn't go forward, and a judge said that the case essentially could go forward. And so it is clear that this is now potentially a suit that he will face, and you saw a royal family that has tried to slowly distance itself from it, and it heard from military veterans and other groups saying that we don't want Prince Andrew associated with our causes with this case hanging over his head and not being resolved yet. And so this was the royal family doing all that it could to distance itself without taking him out of the line of succession, which of course would have its own subsequent consequences to it. And so they've tried to make him a private citizen. And I think it's interesting because what she is arguing in this case is this was power dynamics. She was a teenager. She was put in a vulnerable position by someone who is very powerful. And we've now seen officially some of those ceremonial titles taken from him, and he too now is will be treated as a private citizen by the courts, and in the eyes of the royal family, he should be seen as a private citizen as this case goes forward.
Well, and David, does this buffer the royal family from financial responsibility as well if that civil case is found against him?
Well, that's an interesting question. It certainly doesn't. I mean, I think the reason they're doing this stripping, and he does actually still retain these titles, he's just agreed not to use them publicly, because this is the problem with a hereditary monarchy, is that this is blood descent. The idea is that, almost in a kind of religious sense, the Queen is the head of the church and her children are her heirs. It's a bloodline. And so you can't just fire someone or have them resign when they get into trouble like a politician. The royal family is determined that when he goes to court in New York, he should be a private citizen, but he's not going to be a private citizen. He's going to be a prince, and you can take away his titles, and that's a sensible thing to do. But it is still very, very damaging for an institution that doesn't get to pick and choose its members because it's done by the hereditary principle. And that is the problem with the hereditary principle, and you in the States worked that out a few hundred years ago, rather sooner than we did.
That's David Rennie. He's Beijing Bureau Chief for The Economist. Also with us, Nancy Youssef, a national security correspondent for The Wall Street Journal, and Vivian Salama, a national security reporter for The Wall Street Journal and former Baghdad Bureau Chief for The Associated Press. Vivian, David, Nancy, thanks so much. Chris Castano is 1A's digital editor. Our managing producer is Paige Osborne. Our senior producer is Jonquilin Hill. Mike Kidd is our sound engineer. And Barb Angiano produces our podcast. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. I'm Jen White. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend, and we'll talk again soon. This is 1A.